It's like a whole bunch of meteors falling at one time. The question is, will they hit at one place or will they scatter all over? I don't know.
Trying to predict fallout from congressional gridlock. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, September 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Arctic sea ice heads toward a new record low.
The main story is that the ice is thinner so that it melts out. And we're seeing that more and more, of course.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
As Congress comes back to work after a five-week recess, the White House is going on the offensive, pushing lawmakers to pass what's normally routine legislation instead of getting tied up in politics. But as APRN's Libby Casey reports, the Alaskans in D.C. say this is a time of unparalleled gridlock, and they're looking to the White House to lead.
At the end of this month, the Federal Transportation Department loses its authorization to collect money and spend out new funds on highways, bridges, and transit projects. The White House wants to see Congress extend it, as it typically does. But Obama administration officials, like Transportation Deputy Secretary John Porcari, says there's a risk Congress could get logjammed by partisan disagreements.
We're appealing directly to the American people because the first rule of economic development is you hold on to the jobs that you have. These are people out there working today, building the foundation of America's future prosperity. There have always been philosophical and substantive issues on transportation. They've always been dealt with in a bipartisan way. We think it can be done this time, too.
Porcari says what's spooking the White House is this stalemate that happened last month over reauthorizing the Federal Aviation Administration. Congress left town without dealing with it, leading to a partial shutdown of the FAA that halted construction projects and put federal workers and construction contractors out of a job. A short-term fix was eventually found, but Porcari says it signaled a new game of chicken.
What's different about then and now is what we saw in the FAA bill, which is what had been routine extensions in the past. In the case of the FAA bill, was held up because of ideological issues. That is a sea change.
The White House says if the surface transportation funding isn't extended when it runs out later this month, it could jeopardize more than 8,500 jobs in Alaska and more than 1,100 highway and transit projects in the state. But John Katz, director of the Alaska Governor's Office in Washington, follows these issues closely and isn't overly concerned.
At this point, we don't see much pushback in Congress to the idea of a clean and simple extension of existing transportation law.
Katz says transportation extensions aren't usually partisan, but he admits that he's seeing an unparalleled level of bickering and brinksmanship.
I've been involved in public policy at the federal and state levels for almost 43 years, and never in that period of time have I seen the kind of partisanship and other dynamics which exist now.
Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski agree with Katz that the mood in Washington threatens to hold up important action. Senator Begich says it's going to be a grinding few months as Congress tries to rise above partisan gridlock and tackle issues.
So I do think it's going to be this piece by piece, and then they're all going to kind of clutter up at the end and then collide into a result of some sort. I mean, it's like a whole bunch of meteors falling at one time. The question is, will they hit at one place or will they scatter all over? I don't know.
Begich says the big focus of the coming weeks will be on jobs. And he says President Obama needs to hit a home run Thursday night in his jobs address to Congress. Senator Lisa Murkowski says passing routine legislation and extending things like the transportation bill and the FAA should happen, especially as a way to keep jobs already in place. And she wants to hear concrete plans from the president Thursday night.
It would be helpful if the president would actually announce something new that will actually help to incent job creation. I am, based on the press reports to this point in time, I'm really not anticipating that we're going to see anything or hear anything new. I'd like to be proved wrong on it.
Murkowski has harsh words for the president, who she says has failed to lead on jobs. But the senator says Congress holds some of the blame, too. Both of Alaska's senators plan to attend the president's speech Thursday night. Congressman Don Young is not back in Washington yet, even though the House returned to work Wednesday. His office says he's in Alaska through the week and will be back in the Capitol soon. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Dangerous highways, old bridges, and the Alaska-class ferry top the Alaska Statewide Transportation Improvement Program for the next 4 years. The STIP is Alaska's list of priority state and federal projects from 2012 through 2015, eligible for partial or full federal funding. The Federal Highway Administration requires all state transportation departments to put together a STIP. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more.
The four-year grand total is $3.4 billion. The STIP is front-loaded, partly because federal funding is likely to drop off precipitously by 2014. Most of the money comes from the Highway Trust Fund, fueled by federal gas and other taxes. But DOT Statewide Planning Division Director Jeff Otteson says the trust fund can't keep up with the 50 states' rate of spending.
Congress here to date has three times gone in and given it additional quantities of money from the general fund to basically make the Highway Trust Fund large enough to cover the current level of spending nationwide. Well, everyone's predicting they're not going to do that anymore.
In the first year of the STIP, projects are estimated at $1.3 billion. By 2015, it's down to $500 million. Otteson says federal partners expect states to make reasoned project estimates and show all sources of revenue, even that which is not yet guaranteed by the legislature.
So if we have to live within our means, if we have to live with what the Highway Trust Fund is actually producing in terms of revenue, that is essentially a one-third drop from the current level of spending.
Some of Alaska's most important projects are mainline highways and bridges. More than a dozen need to be replaced.
These bridges are all considered structurally deficient. That is, they're kind of past their useful life, and they're now getting weaker. They don't handle typical highway loads, so we get them replaced.
The most dangerous highways are in south-central Alaska, where fatality rates are high. This year's hot spot is in the Kenai Peninsula.
So just for example, the Kenai Peninsula has had 10 highway fatalities just this summer.
Alaska is part of the National Highway System, which includes such roads as Juneau's Egan Drive, the Klondike and Haines Highways, the Seward, Sterling, Glen, and Parks. Otteson says some NHS sections were built before statehood, and a lot are substandard.
They're very expensive to replace, $3, $4, $5 million a mile.
Local governments and the public nominate projects for the transportation plan. Southeast Region Planner Andy Hughes says each regional office ranks the projects, then DOT headquarters has the task of putting the statewide list together. It's about a two-year process. If funding assumptions are right, Hughes says, most of the projects in the STIP will be built more or less as scheduled. In southeast Alaska, the Haines and Klondike highways are the top priority. They're southeast's link to other parts of the state and Canada. Both are expecting heavy mine traffic out of Canada.
Klondike Highway has become a priority because of the forecast of significantly increased mine haul to Skagway. There's several large Canadian mines that are expected to come online and increase the number of ore trucks on the highway significantly.
Southeast projects total $490 million in the four-year STIP. Otteson says the Alaska Marine Highway System comes in at $264 million, including the Alaska Class Ferry, scheduled for construction next year.
The STIP is portraying what we intend to do in the next 4 years. Like with the Alaska Class, all the money is appropriated, but that $120 million is actually in the STIP because it's going to construction in 2012.
DOT is taking public comments on the four-year statewide transportation improvement plan through September 18th. The STIP can be found on the State Transportation Department website. In Juneau, I'm Rosemary Alexander.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, new Coast Guard response boats come with a few perks.
We have an actual toilet, marine toilet ahead, and we've got a microwave sink.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
The sea ice in the Arctic Ocean is nearly finished with its seasonal melting. Soon, the onset of longer nights will begin freezing it up again, but by the time it's over, this year's sea ice withdrawal may be a record, APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
In the years since the unexpected record sea ice withdrawal of 2007, a survey has been running among computer modelers. One model is the University of Washington PIOMAS, or Pan-Arctic Ice Ocean Modeling and Assimilation System, run by Dr. Jin-Lung Zhang, with data from numerous investigators, including Dr. Ron Lindsay.
My guess is it's about even money. It'll surpass the record of 2007.
Indeed, the latest observations show the sea ice withdrawal at this point tracking the 2007 record almost exactly, according to the National Snow and Ice Data Center. The maximum should be reached in the next couple of weeks, depending in part on how much the ice is scattered by winds and how much it is melted by warm water from underneath. But whether this year is a record or not, the work of Lindsay's group tells us to brace ourselves for more records. Their analysis takes into account the thickness of the ice and says that last year there was less total ice volume in the Arctic than the record year of 2007.
This year is on track to be even lower. Last year, while it was very low, this year is also going to be low. The interesting question here is not so much that it was a record this year or last year. It's that there's a consistent trend. The volume has been going down, as has the ice extent. And so when you have a consistent trend, you, of course, are going to have records from year to year.
It seemed for a while that the sea ice withdrawal had reached some sort of temporary plateau after 2007. The big question was how temporary, and the model from the University of Washington says very temporary. It arrives at this conclusion by incorporating reams of data from hard observations to get a three-decade timeline that enables them to reduce the margins of error in the various forms of measuring.
There are different technologies, and there are different errors associated with all of them. And in addition, the satellite measurements only go back a few years.
Measurements from the U.S. ICESat, for instance, didn't begin until 2003. That satellite died in early 2010 and has not yet been replaced. The PIOMAS model was able to go back long before that, to 1979, using data from moorings and a large number of measurements taken by submarines under the ice.
They go back clear back into the 70s. And although they don't go everywhere and they don't go up all the time, there are substantial amounts of measurements from the submarines.
When the computer's model of ice thickness is incorporated into the maps of sea ice extent, a clear downward trend shows up. The Arctic is losing its thicker ice, the ice that has built up over multiple years. It is not replenishing as strongly as in the past. Some has washed into the Atlantic Ocean, but for whatever reason,
the main story is that the ice is thinner so that it melts out. And we're seeing that more and more, of course.
So when it comes to the actual volume of the Arctic sea ice in the fall, the model says it has been steadily declining for 32 years. PIOMAS does have a 30% margin of error, but even at the limit of that margin, the ice volume last September was a new record and lower than 2007. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
A miner has been killed in an underground accident at the Kensington gold mine. Core Alaska is withholding the victim's name at this time. Company spokeswoman Jan Trigg says the company is investigating the accident and the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration has been notified. An emergency response team is located at the mine, which is about 45 miles northwest of Juneau. This is the first Kensington fatality since the mine opened in June 2010. The contentious issue of coal development held the floor at a packed Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly meeting in Palmer last night. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, homeowners in the vicinity of a proposed Usabelli mining project were not shy about airing their views before the panel.
The flame-like colors of orange and yellow clashed in Palmer Tuesday night, adding heat to an already incendiary issue. Many of those opposed to a borough assembly resolution in favor of a renewal of Usabelli's coal mining permit for the Wishbone Hill project off the Glen Highway near Sutton wore orange T-shirts with a stark message: coal dust blows, while pro-mine activists wore plastic, canary-hued hard hats to show their link with the local mining heritage. Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss authored the resolution asking the State Department of Natural Resources to approve the five-year renewal of Usabelli's existing permit for Wishbone Hill. The resolution, which some assembly members claimed was only made known to them a few days before the meeting, drew the ire of some residents concerned with air and water quality issues related to the mine. Residents like Diana Ramstad and Constance Bredenberg.
So some of you might be asking, why am I wearing this T-shirt? And I have even done some coal mining myself. So I have no problem with Usabelli, personally. I have no problem with people wanting jobs, but I do have a problem, a big problem, with the wind in Palmer, the wind here that's going to take where the Wishbone Hill is and blow it into children's lungs.
There is no such thing as clean coal. There just isn't. And there's collateral damage that's caused by not just mining, but the burning of 500,000 tons of coal a year. And I don't care what country it gets burned in, we all breathe it.
But others petitioned assembly members just as strongly to pass the resolution. At issue, jobs, or the lack of them, and how a meager economy devastates a community. Chuck Bleek and Roberta Mason.
Will this give us jobs? I believe so. Will it give us good jobs? I believe so. These are jobs that are typically union paid, or at least high skill paid jobs.
We don't know our neighbors anymore. Why? Because everybody's going to work somewhere else. They get home in time to go to bed, they get up and they go to work again. We don't see each other. I'd like to say that the mine would bring money. It would put money into the pockets of the people that are working.
The coal resolution highlighted the divide between area residents, between old-timers with deep roots in the 1940s-era coal mining, and younger, more recent arrivals with concerns about health, both human and environmental. Usabelli External Affairs Manager Lorelei Simon told the assembly that the coal permit goes back to 1991, comes up for renewal every 5 years, and that the 31,000-page permit covers environmental quality issues. Although a final decision on the permit renewal is made by the state, Mayor DeVilbiss told the assembly members that the borough needs to get the issue out on the table and deal with it. DeVilbiss admitted his pro-development stance, and most assembly members followed his lead. After the resolution was amended somewhat to reflect borough concerns, the panel wanted to stress that the coal would be shipped from Port McKenzie to its destination overseas. The resolution passed with 5 pro votes. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The latest numbers show promise for a proposed major gold mine at Livengood. The Canadian company International Tower Hill is in the early stages of studying the open pit mine, but a preliminary economic assessment was issued late last month. Project manager Carl Hanneman says the document contains numbers that bode well for the Livengood mine.
The PEA showed that perhaps with a capital investment of about $1.6 billion, we might be able to build a mine with a 23-year mine life and have jobs for generations of Alaskans, and we're real excited about that.
Hanneman says it's estimated that 16 million ounces of gold could be recovered at a mine that would surpass Fort Knox as Alaska's largest surface gold mine. Operating costs are currently estimated at about $550 per ounce. That does not include debt service on construction investment. But with gold at $1,800 an ounce, Hanneman calls the economics robust.
It's a low-grade deposit, but yet it still has gold grades that are just slightly better than currently being mined at Fort Knox. So in terms of kind of a reality test of project economics, it's slightly larger and a little bit better grade than Fort Knox. And so we're real encouraged that with the support of the community and the vendors and the trained workforce here in Fairbanks that we can make this a reality.
It's estimated that Livengood would employ more than 1,000 during construction and about 400 during operation. Hanneman lays out an upcoming 4 to 5 year time frame during which additional studies and permitting will determine whether the project moves ahead.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. A little communication can save a life. Take time to connect with the ones you love and show them you care. This is National Suicide Prevention Week. Know the signs and take them seriously. For help and information, visit carelinealaska.com or call the 24-hour hotline 1-877-266-HELP. This message is sponsored by the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
NOAA Fisheries released the 2010 port rankings for seafood landings today. Dutch Harbor on Alaska is once again at the top of the list in terms of tonnage, with 515.2 million pounds crossing the docks. Reedville, Virginia was number two, 89 million pounds behind. Kodiak was number five, with 325.3 million pounds landed. Cordova was eighth at 147.7 million. Other Alaska towns in the top 20 were Naknek, Ketchikan, Seward, Sitka, and Petersburg. New Bedford, Massachusetts was ninth in poundage, was on top by far in terms of value, with a catch worth $306 million. Dutch was second at $163.1 million, followed by Kodiak at $128.1 million. The U.S. Coast Guard are getting new response boats. The vessels are 45 feet long, aluminum-hulled, sporting twin diesel engines with water jet propulsion. Station Juneau recently got one of the new boats. Another is scheduled to arrive next month. KTOO's Casey Kelly rode along last week.
As far as Coast Guard assets go, Petty Officer Joe Baxter says nothing beats the style, class, and comfort of the new medium response boats.
Crew accommodations, we have an actual toilet, marine toilet ahead, and we've got a microwave, sink, creature comforts that were never on any other Coast Guard boat this size.
The 45-footers are replacing a fleet of 41-foot response boats used at Coast Guard stations nationwide. Station Juneau hasn't had one in over a decade, using a 47-foot motor lifeboat instead. For the newer vessels, Baxter says the Coast Guard made sure to get input from medium response boat crews during the design phase.
They did an excellent job getting operators on the boat, taking recommendations and applying those recommendations. So we sit on this boat, things are where we want them as an operator.
Response boats are primarily used for Coast Guard legacy missions like search and rescue and fisheries and law enforcement. With twin 825 horsepower engines, the new vessels can really fly. Top speed is 40 knots, or about 40 miles per hour.
So we can get on scene a lot quicker.
Of course, there are some major changes. A lot of the older boats in the Coast Guard fleet use outboard engines, but the new ones have a water jet propulsion system. Petty Officer Philip Ketchison says that means learning a new steering method.
Direction you turn the outboard is the direction the boat is going to, your stern will go. This is now the opposite. So rather than we've taught the guys backing down, kind of steer your stern, on this boat, we're teaching them to drive the bow. So wherever you turn your nozzle is a direction the bow is now going to go.
The new medium response boats have been in the works for about 10 years. The Coast Guard ordered 180 of them. The first one was delivered to Station Little Creek, Virginia in 2008. Each one costs about $2 million. When the second one arrives in Juneau in October, it will be based at Auk Bay. The new one that's already here is stationed downtown. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The city of Petersburg has just about finished fixing its collapsed hillside along downtown Hammer Slough. It's also removed the huge pile of debris that settled in the creek after last month's landslide. The work cost less than expected, and much of it will be covered by the federal government. The city council got an update from the city manager last night. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Petersburg's acting city manager and public works director Carl Hagerman officially declared a local disaster shortly after the August 20th slide in the hopes of getting emergency assistance from the state of Alaska. On the advice of state officials, he also requested aid from the National Resource Conservation Service, which has an emergency watershed protection program.
While the disaster declaration didn't really go too far with the state, our disaster wasn't disastrous enough for them. The lead to go to NRCS did pan out to be a very good fit for our problem.
Hagerman told the city council that the federal agency immediately flew two staff members to Petersburg, where heavy rains had caused a large section of the public works parking lot to slide into Hammer Slough. They assessed the damage and accepted the project. They provided engineering services to the city as well as a funding plan in which the agency will pay 75% of the costs incurred after the city signed the agreement. Hagerman was confident the city would be done with the repairs and cleanup in time to meet the NRCS's 10-day deadline for the work.
That work was started immediately upon signing the agreement, and to date is virtually complete. The slope has been completely rebuilt. The debris has been removed from the stream completely. We have some drainage considerations, some storm drainage considerations to do in the parking area, which we're working on the next 2 days. Thursday is the cutoff for the funding from NRCS, and we should have the project completed by then.
The city had initially planned to leave some of the rock and soil in the slough with permission from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. However, according to Hagerman, the NRCS officials took a closer look, and after consulting with the other agencies in the city, they decided all the debris needed to be removed. The NRCS portion of the project is about $116,000, of which the city will only have to pay about $30,000. While the final bills aren't all in, Hagerman estimated the city spent another $25,000 before that agreement.
So that is looking much better than it did a week and a half ago.
The city council had originally authorized Hagerman to spend as much as $250,000, with the expectation that it might end up being even more costly than that. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rosemary Alexander and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
The Rasmussen Foundation Sabbatical Program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.